This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes.
You know what that music is, the opening beats of Billie Jean. This morning, millions of people around the world mourn the death of the king of pop, Michael Jackson, dead at 50. The life and times of a thriller. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, June 26th. I'm Catherine Lanford. We are going through Michael Jackson's legacy, his life, and his music. And we're going to start with Chuck D's of seminal hip-hop group Public Enemy. Hey, good morning, Chuck. Tell us how you see Michael's musical legacy.
First of all, when a person wants to talk about the legacy of music here, when they say Sinatra or Elvis or anybody else, they got to include Michael Jackson in it. He is just, you know, and also internationally resonant.
Okay, Chuck, thanks. Tell you what, stick around. We're going to hear more from Chuck D in just a few minutes. In the show today, we're going to go to Gary, Indiana for Michael Jackson. And yes, we are going to take a break from the King of Pop. We're also going to go to Tehran. More on all of this coming up, but first, these headlines. In Iraq, more than a dozen are dead after an explosion in a Baghdad market. Today, it's part of an uptick in violence ahead of next week's deadline for U.S. troops to leave urban areas. Iran's top legislative body now says that the June 12th election was the fairest Iran has ever held. The opposition continues to say the vote was rigged. And a meeting of foreign ministers from the G8 countries, including the U.S., issued a statement urging Iran to seek a peaceful solution to the disputed election. Here in the U.S., it has emerged that South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford used state money to visit his mistress in Argentina last year. He says he'll pay the money back. On Capitol Hill, House Democrats are trying to force a vote on the climate change bill today. At the White House, the president meets with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Iran tops their agenda. Later today, the White House will announce a new advisor on domestic violence. The U.S.-based pressure group Human Rights Watch has accused Zimbabwe's army of murder in the country's diamond fields. In a report, it says 200 local people were killed. A conference starts today in the Czech Republic on Jewish properties stolen by the Nazis. Representatives of some 50 countries will look at how looted items can be returned to their rightful owners. And in this hour, we're going to get an update on how much Americans are taking home in their paychecks when we get the latest numbers on personal income. Here are some other numbers in world markets yesterday. The Dow and the S&P were both up about 2%. The Dow opens at 84.72. The S&P starts trading at 9.20. The Nasdaq opens trades at 18.30. Never can say goodbye. Michael Jackson has passed away. What if you have to say goodbye? We want to know what he meant to you. What's his legacy? What should the world remember?
I grew up with him from around the same age. Phenomenal musical talent, and I think that's really how he has to be remembered. All the controversy is ridiculous. Let's focus on the good stuff, the music.
All right. We want to hear from you. It's 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Let us know how you remember the King of Pop.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
The song that started it all, For the Jackson 5, anyway, I Want You Back from 1969. I'm Catherine Lamford, in for John Hockenberry, who's away. There's no getting back the king of pop, however. Michael Jackson is dead at 50 after suffering a cardiac arrest at his house in Los Angeles. His career spanned 40 years. It took in Motown and MTV, R&B and dance videos, a duet with a Beatle, and the moonwalk. It also included such tabloid curiosities as his plastic surgeries, his ranch Neverland in Southern California, and the allegations of child molestations, of which he was acquitted. We're going to remember now the King of Pop in his entirety. We're going to go from Chuck D with the seminal hip-hop group Public Enemy, also Brian Raftery, a contributing writer for Spin Magazine. And, of course, we're going to go to Farai Chidea. She is a journalist, novelist, and a friend here at The Takeaway. But, Chuck D, we're gonna go back to you. Where were you when you first heard that Michael Jackson had died? What was your first reaction?
Well, I actually was in flight going from New York to L.A., and right in the middle of the flight, I saw breaking news on the TV sets. And, you know, these flights now, you get online, so I was on Wi-Fi at the same time. So, ironically, I was landing in the same place that all the frenzy was happening with Michael Jackson at UCLA. And I was like, matter of fact, going up to Ventura, California, where I stay, made sure that I wouldn't take the 405, take the 1 to avoid all the traffic that was building up as is and around UCLA. So, I mean, it was kind of shocking.
How would you say that Michael Jackson has influenced you?
Well, he's been there along the soundtrack of my life, you know. I mean, I was in fourth grade when that record came out, and it set fire with all the, especially young girls at the time with the Jackson 5. And yesterday when I talked to some journalists, they asked me to name 3 records, which is hard to do over a 40-year period of music of Michael Jackson. But I immediately said, Got to Be There, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, and Rock With You, just 3 different records from 3 different type of sonic environments that Michael Jackson was able to give us. And you know, I tell you, the shock to white America a while ago is when I told people, I said, hey, man, a lot of my catalog goes before, you know, when America started finding out about Michael Jackson. And that was as the Jackson 5 and then the Jacksons, produced by Gamble and Huff. And then, you know, when most of America really caught Michael Jackson craziness, was a Thriller. But, you know, I've been kind of like acclimated to Michael Jackson growing up as a kid.
And we're going to go now to Farai Chidea, who might have been one of those young girls who were so sweet on Michael Jackson. Farai?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I'm sorry I can't always hear you 100% well because I am in an airport. And I found out about Michael Jackson when I was on a train yesterday coming into Philadelphia. Now I'm leaving. And it was interesting because it was like one of those Twitter moments where everyone was like, yes, we heard he's sick. No, he's dead. No, he's not dead. No one's confirmed it. And eventually things sorted themselves out into something that looked like the truth, which made us all very sad. And then people just started playing a lot of records and coming up with their favorite songs. But yes, he was someone, you know, one of the comments I saw last night on Twitter was that the reporter Lisa Ling said, R.I.P. Michael Jackson, my first boyfriend. And I think that could have been a lot of people. You know, I was someone who had a huge crush on Michael because he just seemed like, you know, he was a man, you know? And it's just so many layers of tragedy that have...
Now, Farai, I know that you...
On his life and through his life.
You talked about layers of tragedy. I know that you have been tweeting about this. Talk about a race as a conundrum for Michael Jackson.
I think that this is a country of self-reinvention, but you always pay a price, no matter what you do. You know, we're used to reinvention of, you know, the pauper becoming the millionaire, the fat girl getting thin, people changing their nose and their accent. You know, but Michael, I think what strikes me is that I don't know what Michael would have been if he could have been anything. He's so clearly had some kind of dysmorphic relationship to his body. He was literally not comfortable in his skin. He didn't seem to find that space where he was who he was. And yet, you know, regardless of whatever else may have played into his decision, there was a lot of racial chit-chat and, you know, wailing and gnashing of teeth, because they said, how could this cute young black boy essentially want to look as different as possible from what his body was telling him to look like?
I want to make sure that we get Chuck D responding to this as well. Chuck?
Yeah, I think Farah is right. And also, as a black man, I just feel like, you know, the mess of multimedia coverage over the last 15 or 20 years has just been a bunch of crap to me. And yesterday was a sad and a bad day for me, because I think Michael Jackson died of a broken heart and a broken soul, and the same fame that he thrived on, that these boardrooms create, I think he felt chained to it, and I think it was painful. And I don't think, you know, the thing is the hypocrisy of this country is that now fame means it's the worst side of you would get the most coverage. And it's kind of like, you know, haunting that these record companies wouldn't give them the light of the day, or these radio stations wouldn't give them the light of the day over the last couple of years. But when he dies, now everybody's on his jock, so to speak. And it makes me angry, because in the end, no matter how much he messed with himself or his appearance, which to me, you know, didn't mean anything to anybody when it came down to him wanting to entertain and just make people have a good time. You know, I just thought that all that was irrelevant. And now you see all these areas of multimedia praising them and jocking them. But once again, you know, as a black man dead, you know, it's just convenient for American media and much for the people that live in it. So I feel kind of crappy about the hypocrisy of this country and its coverage.
Brian Raftery, I want to turn to you, a contributing writer for Spin magazine. Put the death of Michael Jackson in context for us. The Beatles, Elvis, where does it fit?
Kind of a little bit of everything. I mean, what's really amazing about Michael Jackson is that if you were to take even just one song from his career, if he'd only had Thriller with the video, if he'd only had Billie Jean with the bass line, you know, if he'd only had Want to Be Starting Something with, you know, the sort of big chant at the end, those all would have been, are all landmark pop records. And the fact is, when you start talking about Michael Jackson's legacy, you could go for hours, if not days, in every single medium. I mean, film, music, TV, in terms of just what it meant to be a celebrity, how celebrity culture changed along with Michael Jackson, possibly because of Michael Jackson. I mean, it's fascinating. He was in every single part of American culture in terms of the whole spectrum of good and bad, of how you can sort of bring yourself into the world of music and then take it beyond it.
We're going to go back to Chuck D. Chuck D, given what you were saying, if you could mastermind how Michael Jackson's going to be remembered, what should we remember? What should we hold on to?
That he's the greatest entertainer of all time, of our later times. And I just think that if everybody's going to spend time worrying about, you know, like Elvis, should we have the good-looking 1956-style Elvis? And they never hardly talk about the 1972 drug-infested Elvis. I think you got to talk about Michael Jackson without talking about all those 90-ish nightmarish cases that you know, everybody seemed to think of him as. And, you know, I think of Michael Jackson as a brilliant artist and entertainer, and all those other issues about the plastic surgery or the child molestation. They're irrelevant to me.
Okay. Chuck D, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Chuck D of the seminal hip-hop group Public Enemy. We also heard from Farai Chidea, journalist, novelist, and friend here at The Takeaway, and Brian Raftery, a contributing writer for Spin magazine. Michael Jackson died yesterday at the age of 50. Let's just listen.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Michael Jackson has died at the age of 50, and we want to know, what did he mean to you?
My name is Don Merrill in Salt Lake City. First, it's just really hard to hear the words Michael Jackson and autopsy in the same sentence, but it just, goes to show that this man was able to make himself into exactly what he wanted, and I'm not really sure he was happy with what he got.
Go ahead, tell us. What do you think his legacy is? What is it that he wanted? What is it that he got? What should the world remember? Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Meanwhile, moving on to Iran, the rhetoric between the White House and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is heating up. The Obama administration accusing Ahmadinejad of trying to blame the United States for the unrest that erupted onto Iranian streets following its contested presidential election. Joining me right now is Riz Khan. He's host of the Riz Khan Show on Al Jazeera English. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Catherine. Thank you.
Now, what we're hearing today is that the Guardian Council is coming out and saying that this was the fairest election ever held in Iran. We've been getting sort of backwards and forward signals. There was a thought at one point there were going to be recounts. What's going on? How do you make sense of this?
It's a very tricky one for the Guardian Council to manage in Iran, because they've got obviously sort of what looks like a popular uprising on the streets. We've got to remember that 30 years ago there was a complete change in Iran because of what happened. And I think that it's become a spin game to a large degree. But one thing's interesting, I think that, the pictures, a lot of people are complaining now, no one's showing the other side in the West, that, you know, Ahmadinejad also has supporters. So it's important to realize there is obviously division within Iran itself.
And there are analysts who say, in fact, he might have even won.
Exactly. So it's a difficult one to call. It seems strange, you know, just prior to the election, I was doing a show on Iran and looking ahead to what might happen during the election. And it just seemed with the high turnout, all the predictions that Mousavi had it in the bag seemed very likely. Then, of course, it was a big surprise to see the margin of victory. And I think that's what's shocked a lot of people, the margin of victory that Ahmadinejad has had.
So if we go to Iran today, things are very, very quiet. Today is a day of prayers. There have been several of them. What are we supposed to be looking for today?
I think it's going to be the rhetoric within the mosques, the way the people are being guided by those who are preaching the sermons. Because Friday is a time when people come together. The Friday prayer is pretty much the most important time when people gather in the Muslim world. And it's when, of course, the West, of course, accuses the radical mullahs and clerics of rallying people against the West and rallying people against things outside. But it's also a time when those who are more moderate and more willing to accept a different situation also rally those who support that idea. So I think it's really how the public will be guided by the people who speak in the mosques. But there's a potential for it to flare up if things really do heat up with the rhetoric from the mullahs.
Yeah, and you talk about a potential for people to be guided. Of course, in the rest of the world, we're guided by whatever reporting gets out.
Right.
Talk about, obviously, the Iranian government has been critical of the BBC. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if they've also been critical of Al Jazeera English.
Al Jazeera, they see you as another Western voice. Al Jazeera is in an interesting position because, of course, you know, there's some division between Iran and large parts of the Arab world as well. And Al Jazeera has always been one of those channels that has stood there and been willing to point fingers, willing to be more sort of democratic in its approach. And it's offended many of the Arab governments as well. So, yeah, Al Jazeera is not always in the best position, largely because of trying to sort of take the straight path of truth and fact and factual reporting. So, yeah, it's not easy either way. But definitely the effort to control the media in Iran is one of the big stories here. And it's been shown how modern media is much harder to control. I think that's one of the big pictures that have come out.
How has Al Jazeera English covered the Twitter story?
Well, no, we have. I mean, ironically, we're, of course, a channel that uses new technology as well. So, you know, we've seen... there was the talk about this being the first Twitter revolution, what's happening in Iran. But people are saying it's not really quite as big as that. There's a large portion of the country that doesn't have access to new media. So, again, people could say those who have access to Twitter and Facebook and so on are those who are more in the elite or the upper middle classes.
And getting back to everyone that the Iranian government is blaming, there is the BBC, mm-hmm. There's the Obama White House, but it's also other parts of the Mideast as well.
That's right. Well, as I say, the divisions that have existed between, if you like, the Persian world and the Arab world, that's often forgotten in the West. You know, a lot of Iranians get offended by being called Arab. The difference, of course, between the Shia and Sunni worlds, if you like, and Iran being the hub of the Shia world. Which obviously puts it at odds with places like Saudi Arabia, where it's the strong Sunni and some say Wahhabism that really guides the Middle East.
Talk about there are some analyses that are coming forward now that talk about how the Iranian government can sort of effectively muffle this protest movement that was building. If we were going to see that happening, I mean, there's talk of already one minority candidate has said, I'm going to do this through legal channels. How can we see this breaking down, if you will? It seems so impossible that a week ago we had people in the streets, there was going to be change, and now?
Well, it's hard to tell because there's actually quite a vibrant society in Iran where people are willing to discuss things, and I think people forget that too. It is actually quite a vibrant society. How much is expressed openly is the difficult part. And then, of course, there's the issue that the candidates were approved candidates in the first place. That, you know, the people who ran, as far as, you know, you might say someone so-and-so is moderate, they were still an approved candidate. So how much would change if Mir Hossein Mousavi was to come in? There's no guarantee that there's going to be any major change either way.
One thing that does seem to be uniting the world today, and that is the mourning of the death of Michael Jackson. Before we move on to headlines, quite briefly, how is Al Jazeera English covering this?
Well, it's funny because I had a whole bunch of calls yesterday. Originally, years ago, I was I know Yuri Geller, the paranormalist, pretty well, who was very close friends with Michael Jackson at one stage, and he was trying to arrange for me to do an interview with him. And I happened to go away. I was traveling overseas when a slot came up, and that ended up going to a former colleague of mine from the BBC, Martin Bashir. So it was quite funny. And the irony was that I actually had played drums at a Michael Jackson concert. Only one track, and it was very bizarre, years ago. But no, I'm not that good a drummer.
Riz Khan, I want to thank you for joining us. Riz Khan is the host of The Riz Khan Show on Al Jazeera English. And now we're going to turn to Richard Hake, who has the latest for us from the newsrooms. Richard?
And Catherine, good morning. An autopsy on singer Michael Jackson is planned for later today. The results aren't likely to be final, though, for days or even weeks. The pop singer's death has sparked sales of his music. His albums took up three-quarters of the best-selling list on the web retailer Amazon.com. Fans of the television star Farrah Fawcett are also remembering her today. She died of cancer at the age of 62 yesterday. South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford said he used state money to visit his mistress in Argentina while on a trip there last year. Sanford says he'll pay it back, but calls for his resignation continue. This week, he admitted to having an affair and misleading the public. In Iraq, the number of people killed in a Baghdad blast is now up to at least 15. A booby-trapped motorcycle loaded with nails and ball bearings exploded in a crowded market. U.S. troops are due to pull out of urban areas in just 4 days.
All right. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Oh, going back to Indiana. That's a song recorded by the Jackson 5 for their ABC TV special of the same name. You might remember it if you were around in 1971. When news of Michael Jackson's death broke, people in and around his hometown of Gary, Indiana, did the one thing they could think of. They went to 2300 Jackson Street, his childhood home. We're going now to Chicago Public Radio reporter Michael Puente. He was in Gary last night, and he's with us now. Gary, what was the... Excuse me, Gary. Michael, what was this scene like last night?
Well, it was, kind of surreal, really. I mean, almost immediately here, I thought I was going to be one of the first reporters or first people on the scene. But as I got there, there was at least 100 people already gathered, several TV cameras, several helicopters overhead. The only time you usually see helicopters over Gary is just to report, like, the traffic or some big fire or something. And, it was just so... Like I said, it's surreal that you're there reporting and you're catching yourself. My God, you're reporting on the death of Michael Jackson, and it just didn't seem real. And for a lot of people there, I mean, people were just gathering, and some were bringing in flowers to just like a little one story ranch home, a couple of bedrooms in there.
I was just going to say, Michael, for those of us who aren't there, paint me the word picture. What's the house look like? How many people?
House,
was it dark?
No, it wasn't dark. It sits on a corner. The actual address is 2300 Jackson Street. Wasn't named after Michael Jackson. I mean, now it's called, Michael Jackson Boulevard or the Jackson 5 Boulevard. But at the time, it was named after Andrew Jackson, the president of the United States, former president. And it's right outside of a high school where some of the Jackson family went, Roosevelt High School. And it's kind of in a working class, lower income neighborhood that has seen some troubled times, and the home has been sitting there for decades now. And
does anyone live in it?
As of right now, I do not believe so. I don't think there's a family living in there right
now.
Okay,
how many people were there last night?
Oh, at least a couple of hundred walking back and forth, and onlookers, fans, people coming, leaving teddy bears. And
what did it sound like? What noises were there? Were there praying? Were there songs?
Actually, a lot of people were driving by with their car radios on, playing Michael Jackson tunes, everything from Ben to Beat It to Thriller to the older stuff, the newer stuff, and people just gathering a lot. And as I stood there for a while, you started hearing more and more tears. People actually, the people in the neighborhood who remember Michael, some of the people in the neighborhood who remember Michael growing up, starting to cry a little bit and really setting in that not only did they lose this great entertainer, but one of the city's favorite sons.
Your father worked with Michael Jackson's father, Joe, years ago in a steel mill. And I'm wondering, what stories do you remember? Do you remember your dad telling,
God.
Huh?
Oh, my God, yeah. My dad, Jesus Puente, who passed away about 5 years ago, worked in, Joe Jackson, the big stories are that he worked at U.S. Steel in Gary, but he also spent time as a crane man in neighboring the city of East Chicago, Indiana, at Inland Steel, which is now ArcelorMittal. So my dad would tell me these, these not fantastical stories, but just a couple of stories that, Michael Jackson's father, really nice guy, down to earth, very friendly. So some of these stories came out that he was kind of abusive and pretty, tough sometimes on his family. He couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that this Joe Jackson that he worked with was this guy, because it was such a nice guy to him.
Okay, Michael, thank you. Thank you so much for reporting to us. Michael Puente is a Chicago Public Radio reporter, and he went to Indiana yesterday. He went to the scene outside of Michael Jackson's childhood home. All right, from the streets of Gary, Indiana, to the streets of Tehran. We had the chance earlier this morning to go to BBC Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen. He is the BBC's last reporter in Tehran. And when we spoke, I asked him, I said, describe the scene in Tehran today.
When you ask Iranians about the way things are going at the moment and the way they're likely to go, because the street protests have pretty much died down because of the iron fist of the authorities here, they use this phrase, which they use apparently a lot in Farsi, in Persian, which is there's fire under the ashes. And so under the ashes of protest, there's something smouldering. And, you know, clearly the implication is that that's the way you light another fire. You just add a bit of paper to it and, boom, it'll go up. Longer term, the question here for the regime is whether or not the really serious rift that's opened up in the elite of Iran, a big fracture, whether that is going to heal or whether that will be now a continuing and determining factor of the way that things are done here.
Now, we know that today is a day of prayers. It's Friday. Everyone's going to be gathering around. What are the expectations of the messages that will be coming down from the imams and others?
Well, actually, strangely enough, today they've had the prayer here, and there was nothing new particularly in it, but the messages have been coming out constantly from the official media here, and pretty much all the media is official, certainly on the TV, and that is that the election is fair, it's fine, it's going to stand, don't protest. If you protest, you're in big trouble. I mean, that's the consistent message that's been coming out from the supreme leader down, and that is continuing. And the Guardian Council, which supervises elections, is due to finally, definitively sign off the election on Sunday, but already it's indicating there's absolutely nothing wrong with it as far as it's concerned.
They've called it the fairest election ever.
Yeah, well, that doesn't come as a surprise, because whether or not it's the fairest election ever, a majority of the Guardian Council's members, I understand, campaigned actively for Ahmadinejad before the elections. So it's not like that they're a dispassionate body.
All right. And quickly, how are you getting around? Is that anything you can tell us?
I'll tell you what I've been told here about the rules. I can drive around like a tourist. In other words, I can get in a car and go somewhere. But what I can't do is report from the streets. And I can't report on any opposition gathering, because all opposition gatherings are illegal, and I can't report on illegal gatherings. So it's a question of how you interpret it, and really what it comes down to is whether or not you get into trouble. So because of the very strict atmosphere against foreigners here at the moment, and against journalists, quite frankly, I'm being very careful. I'm being a very good boy, and I'm observing the rules, and I do my reporting from the office.
That is BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, a very good boy. The last BBC reporter in Tehran, he spoke to us earlier this morning. Meanwhile, we've also been talking about Michael Jackson today, who died yesterday at the age of 50. We want to know, what is the first one of his songs you heard?
Hey, this is Mark in Brooklyn. Michael Jackson, wow. Michael Jackson Thriller was the first tape I ever bought. I was 8 years old. That's how important he was.
Tell us what Michael Jackson's legacy is for you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Before the news of Michael Jackson's death hit the nation, we were already mourning another cultural star.
And on a different note, also Farrah Fawcett passed away. It's a shame that it's being eclipsed by Michael Jackson, but she was also a phenomenal woman, and I hope that's acknowledged today.
We're going to do our best. The actress Farrah Fawcett passed away yesterday afternoon after a long battle with cancer. She had a face that launched a million lunchboxes, a smile that launched 12 million posters, and if you're of a certain age, you remember that poster in the dorm room, and a haircut that has inspired generations of dudes. Joining me this morning is April Barton. She is a celebrity hairstylist. She's the owner of the salon Suite 303 in the Chelsea Hotel here in New York. All right, not that anyone could ever forget Farrah's hair, but could you describe what her hairstyle was? What was it called? What's its impact?
Oh, the Farrah. Good morning, everybody. Farrah Fawcett, the legendary, legendary fashion icon, the smile that would just ice over the world. Yeah, the legendary haircut of Farrah Fawcett. She had naturally curly hair. And at that time, I believe it was José Aubert, a French hairstylist that, he didn't have a celebrity following. She was his first. And he was, yeah, pursued by Saudi Arabian women and Beverly Hills. And we want the Farrah Fawcett.
I love the fact that when you look at a picture of her, you instantly see an entire history of hair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when I look at a picture of Farrah Fawcett, I think of generations of women who ended up getting that funny little flip they did with the curling iron with the bang, which was sort of the low rent approximation of the Farrah do. So explain to me the good that Farrah's hair did for a nation of hairdos.
The nation of the hair. She had naturally curly hair. So it wasn't like somebody with light, fine hair doing this big blowout. That was the minimal that her hair would do, given... I believe that possibly she tried to fit in with the other girls on Charlie's Angels. Like, she had to blend. And by blowing out her hair, she ended up being the biggest and baddest and the most popular of the Charlie's Angels due to that hair.
Now, what did her look say about her? What was the message she gave off with her hair and that smile and also the fact she was in shape?
Sexy, confident, comfortable in her own skin. Even her hairdresser gave the credit to her. The way that she smiled, the way that she moved, the way that she was so confident and free with her hair.
What was it about her hair that made so many women want to do it? When, let's get real, you know, even if you give yourself the bangs, you're not going to look like Farrah Fawcett.
Exactly. That's why I have to say that's what I do for a living, and it's really external. It's what you see, but I got to tell you, it comes from within. You know, if someone really feels confident, it portrays on the outside.
Okay. In the short time that we have remaining, you walk down on the streets of America. What vestiges of Farrah's hair do you see?
Yeah, we see a little Farrah in somebody. Even in the middle of a blowout, you'd be like, that's very Farrah. And then it takes one twist for a change, and it's out of the Farrah and into something different or contemporary.
You talked about the internal. Again, we have seconds here, but we're talking about her hair, but we're really talking about something a little deeper here.
Yeah, it is. It's her beauty on the inside. I mean, I think any hairstyle that she would have wore would have probably taken off because she was so magnetic and had so much to share.
April, thank you so much. April Barton, celebrity hairstylist. And rest in peace, Farrah Fawcett.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, and here is Richard Haig with more headlines.
And Catherine, good morning. An autopsy for Michael Jackson is planned for later today, but final results aren't likely until toxicology tests are completed next week. Here's a close friend of Michael Jackson's, performer Uri Geller.
He was a confused man and a lonely person. The reason was, I believe, is because nobody really understood Michael Jackson.
But Geller says Jackson was happiest when performing and seeing his fans.
I think he was a happy man when fans were around him. He drank their love.
And you can see that this morning. Fans are holding vigils outside the Los Angeles hospital where Jackson died. It's emerged that South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford used state money to visit his mistress in Argentina last year. He says he'll pay the money back. The five remaining defendants of the Gina 6 case in Louisiana are expected to plead guilty in court today after reaching a deal with prosecutors. The group is accused of beating a white schoolmate. At the White House, the president meets with the German chancellor today. Iran tops their agenda. And in Iran, a senior Iranian cleric is asking the government to harshly punish the leaders of post-election protests. The Ayatollah spoke during Muslim Friday prayers at Tehran University. Meanwhile, foreign ministers from the group of eight countries are calling for the immediate end of violence in Iran.
All right. Thank you so much, Richard.
You're welcome.
We've been talking about Michael Jackson all morning and reporting to you a lot from the domestic scenes of mourning. But now we're going to turn to Roz Atkins. He's the host of the BBC's global news program, World Have Your Say. Millions around the world are mourning the death of Michael Jackson. And we've asked Roz to share with us a little bit of the reaction. Okay, Roz, what are some of the best reactions you've been hearing around the world?
there are very few stories which are genuinely global, where our listeners respond from all parts of the globe, and this is definitely one of them. We're almost up to 10,000 comments just coming into BBC News Online since Michael Jackson's death has been announced. Atha in Chandigarh says, "You rule this world." Timofey in St. Petersburg said, "You changed my world. Thank you, Mike." I can see one here from Tariq in Dubai saying, "God bless you, Michael. You were my friend when I was a teenager. I can't believe you're gone." And Esau in Liberia has just emailed, "His death is like a bolt of lightning in my stomach." And to be honest, I could give you a very, very long list of the countries where we're hearing from. The only real negative to the reaction we're getting is some people saying you're giving too much time to this story. Ian is in the States and says, "Michael Jackson, Michael Jackson, it's all I'm hearing from the BBC. What about proper news?" And Ebony in Amsterdam says, "He was a great singer, but that was all. Enough of the coverage." But to be honest, for every comment like that, we're getting strong rebuttals. Stanislas in Greece has just posted on worldhaveyoursay.com responding to this criticism, saying, "He was the model for a whole generation. Michael Jackson is to music what Oprah and Obama are to television and politics. Of course, we should talk to him." And the vast, vast majority of our listeners all around the world are shocked by the news and are mourning him, and are at the moment maybe shifting from sadness to more celebration, and they're beginning to trade what their favourite songs are and their most favourite Michael Jackson memories are.
Okay, well, thank you so much. There you have it, a snapshot of the world reaction to the death of Michael Jackson from the BBC's global news discussion program, World Have Your Say. That's Roz Atkins. Now, let's go back a little.
Way over the rainbow, way up high.
40 years ago this weekend, we were mourning the death of a very different icon, Judy Garland, which led to another news story. They were denizens of a West Village gay bar were mourning when the New York City police raided the Stonewall Inn. Raids on the bar had happened before, but this time it was different. Gay men, drag queens, a few women fought back. It turned into a six-day rebellion that sparked the modern civil rights movement for the gay community. We have David Bermudez here. He was with us that night. He was 26 years old, and now he's joining us from northeastern Massachusetts. We also have with us 29-year-old Jason Hawes, a civil rights leader in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. He's here with me in the studio. Now, David, you heard Judy Garland singing "Somewhere Over the Radio," "Somewhere Over the Rainbow." Now, tell me, did that bring you back at all?
Oh, bring me lots and lots of memories. She was a wonderful entertainer. She was an icon to us, as Michael is to all the young people today. And when that song plays, I get extremely emotional.
Well, let me take you back to whether or not that song was playing. You were mourning Judy Garland that night at the Stonewall Inn. Give us a quick picture of what happened that night.
Well, we went to the Stonewall bar in Greenwich Village, you know, to celebrate her life. And we got to the bar, and while we were in the bar, you know, we used to have raids in the 60s. Cops would come in and harass us and push us around and put us in paddy wagons use us as pawns.
And what was your crime, essentially?
Our crime was just that we were gay.
So there you are. It's just another raid like it is any other night. What was different that night? What happened?
That night was different because, you see, when we were raided, we never fought back. Never, ever fought back. And at that night, I feel that because of Judy Garland's death and all that, we just had it. Enough was enough. So when the cops started hitting us and harassing us and putting us in paddy wagons and all, we just went ahead and fought back and started hitting back.
Now, Jason Hawes, I want to turn to you. Here you are, a civil rights activist, hearing someone talk about a time when, well, you never fought back. Talk about the legacy of Stonewall and how things have changed.
Well, I thank you to David for, you know, being the first guard in the modern civil rights movement, the modern LGBT rights movement. I've been fighting, I guess, ever since I was young. I came out very young and was able to do so much because of the generations that came before me, the gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender people who, fought back. I came out when I was 13, I believe, in a public school in Boston that was, you know, anything but accepting and safe for LGBT students or students perceived as such.
But I think we have here a wonderful example of the difference between the generations because, David, the idea of even coming out in junior high or high school?
You know, I was coming out after a divorce.
that's just one example. So I'm wondering, what generation gap is there between the different generations, the Stonewall generation and now someone who can identify himself as an activist with the LGBT community? Jason, what distance do you see, if any?
In the last 40 years, we've come a long way in the media. In society's perceptions of gay and lesbian folks, and maybe to a lesser extent the transgender community, but I think, other than that time, a lot has happened in that time. I mean, during the '80s, there's the HIV/AIDS crisis, especially here in New York City, and then in the '90s we had a major setback of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. And now all the while we were fighting for, hate crimes legislation, federal hate crimes legislation, that's fully inclusive. And we're still, that fight continues today. So, other than having, that 40 years time, I think we're still very much fighting for the same things. And that's, basic human rights and basic civil rights for LGBT folks.
And David, how do you commemorate this weekend? How far do you think people have come?
Well, to be honest with you, the Cape Cod Community College, I talked about Stonewall about 6 months ago to a bunch of students, expecting like 20 students, and over 225 students showed up. And it was fantastic. They wanted to know everything that was going on. They were in awe when I was telling them about us being beat up and harassed. And I think there's a very, very big difference right now with how the young people think and what they want to learn. They really, really want to learn.
And, we still have, so many problems that are, facing our schools. And there's, legislation that has yet to be passed in many states, basically doing away with name-calling and bullying based on perceived or actual sexual orientation or against gender identity.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both. That's Jason Haas. He's a civil rights activist and a member of the LGBT community. And David Bermudez, a veteran of Stonewall. What have been the big gay rights battles since Stonewall? Well, go to thetakeaway.org for our timeline of the gay rights movement.
Chuck, Chuck, Chuck went the motor. Bump, bump, bump went the brakes.
That's Rufus Wainwright singing Judy Garland. But you know that we've been talking about Michael Jackson today. He died yesterday at the age of 50. And we've been asking you, what do you think Michael Jackson's legacy will be?
It's not what Michael Jackson meant or was to us. It's what he's left us. He's left us years and years of watching his children suffer as surrogate mothers and fathers place claim to his legacy. He was a man out of control and didn't know what he wanted, and now he's left his children with that.
He left a more positive effect with our listener Effie. She writes to us, "I will remember him as a gentle, fragile soul with an explosive and dynamic brilliance." Give us your take at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Who's bad?
Michael Jackson, the king of pop, is dead at 50. So what happens when you have to say goodbye? Figuring out a farewell, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, June 26th. I'm Catherine Lanfer. We're going through Michael Jackson's legacy, his life, and his music. Almost immediately last night after the news hit of Michael Jackson's death, mourners started gathering at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. The Jackson 5 made their debut there in 1969. Our own Terrence McKnight was there. He's the host of WNYC's Evening Music. Terrence, quick, give us the scene at the Apollo Theater last night.
So I get to the Apollo probably about 11 o'clock last night.
Yeah.
And there were hundreds of people out there. On the right side of the street, on my right side of the street, under the Apollo marquee, there were people out there. There were lots of television cameras. There were people selling T-shirts. There were people buying T-shirts. And lots of heated conversation and discussion about his legacy. On the other side of the street, there were probably, I don't know, Catherine, maybe 100 or so people out there singing his song. Somebody had a boombox.
A real boombox?
A real boombox.
Not an iPod?
That's
Come
right,
on.
A real boombox. And it was like karaoke for group singing because it would just go from hit to hit to hit. And you had these, what impressed me, you had teenagers and people in their 20s who couldn't have been born when a lot of this music was written, and they knew all the words. And it was a real scene. And I left it around midnight and people were still coming.
We're going to keep coming with more memories of Michael Jackson. So you stick around, Terrence. Meanwhile, these other headlines. In Iran, a senior Iranian cleric is asking the government to harshly punish the leaders of post-election protests. The Ayatollah spoke during Friday prayers at Tehran University. Here in the U.S., it's emerged that South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford used state money to visit his mistress in Argentina last year. He says he'll pay the money back. And the five remaining defendants of the Gina 6 case in Louisiana are expected to plead guilty in court today after reaching a deal with prosecutors. The group is accused of beating a white schoolmate on Capitol Hill. House Democrats are trying to force a vote on the climate change bill today before they go on break. And at the White House, the president meets with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Iran tops their agenda. In world markets today, the Dow and the S&P both up about 2%. The Dow opens this hour at 84.72. The S&P starts trading at 9:20. The Nasdaq opens trades at 18:30. The king of pop is dead. Tell us what Michael Jackson meant to you. What's the first Michael Jackson song you heard?
My mom bought these little record players for kids. And what my mother brought home for me was I'll Be There.
What is the legacy of Michael Jackson for you? What should the world remember? Are you going to be there? Let us know. 877-8-MY-TAKE, 877-869-8253, or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. John Hockenberry is away. After the news of Michael Jackson's death, his fans went out into the streets and to the places in which he was most associated in their cities. In New York, that meant they gathered at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. In Detroit, people found themselves standing on the steps of the Motown Historical Museum. Now, joining us now are two people who also felt compelled to go down and see what was going on. Terrence McKnight is the host of WNYC's Evening Music. He went out last night to check out the Apollo. Amanda LeClaire is a producer at WDET in Detroit, one of our partners, and she headed towards Motown. All right, Terrence, I want to start with you. Hundreds of people gathering outside the Apollo. What kind of conversations did you pick up?
Some of the conversation dealt with Michael's legacy and what would be his legacy. I heard conversations about his skin, conversations about his nose, conversations about his hair. Conversations about the children and the lovers and the music, you know. And there were very heated discussions about that. And as I mentioned, you know, there were people out there selling T-shirts, but there were people out there. I think Catherine, the mood was more celebratory than anything. Even though there were heated discussions, people were just really celebrating this guy's music, and they were standing in front of the Apollo, almost expecting something to happen.
I don't know if we were expecting Michael to walk out of the Apollo and say it was a hoax. I don't know, but people were just standing and waiting and watching and looking and singing. So it was a huge celebration for him last night.
Now, Amanda, how does that compare to what you saw in Detroit? Give us that picture.
In Detroit, I think the difference was that what I kept hearing was people saying that despite whatever controversy he had in his life, they were remembering him for the music, and that was what it was all about, the music that touched so many people.
I like this idea you were saying, Terrence. It was almost as if they expected something to happen. There was something happening, and that was the fact that all these people were gathering together. Talk about the generational differences that you saw. I'll start with Terrence, but I'd like to hear from you too, Amanda.
Well, I saw probably kids as young as, I don't know, 15, and up through, you know, maybe 60, 65. So there were people, you know, who probably remembered Michael Jackson and his brothers from the 60s, and there were young people that really impressed me, you know, who couldn't have been around when this music was written and yet knew so many of the words. And if they didn't know the words, they certainly knew the tunes. So, you know, when the words faded, people were just humming and yelling, "We love you, Michael." And so I was really moved by the fact that he inspired so many people from so many different generations and so many ethnicities. Whoever lived in that neighborhood where near the Apollo came out, so you saw a very diverse crowd.
Hey, Amanda, I know that you talked to several fans, including Dolores Brown. Let's hear from her now.
There'll never be another Michael Jackson. There'll never be another king of pop like him, because he was Michael in his own right. He was natural. He was gifted. And all I want to say is God bless his family. My prayers are with his family and his children. And it's just a great loss for us today.
That's Dolores Brown. She was one of the Michael Jackson fans gathered in Detroit in front of the Motown Historical Museum. Now, Amanda, how focused were people on Jackson's connection to Motown in the conversations you heard last night?
Well, it definitely kept coming up. I think people felt that. They felt that connection to him through Motown, the Jackson 5 being one of the groups that really cemented Motown as the legendary label that it was. So they were feeling that a lot. I mean, there were also, Dolores was one of the people there. She was a little bit older, and she looked like she was in shock. You know, she definitely seemed like she was going through a stage of grief. There were other people there who were younger, who were just, they'd grown up on his music through his parents, and they were more celebrating how he influenced the music they listen to now.
Oh, in fact, Terrence, talk about that for a minute. I think that for the casual listener to Michael Jackson, and they do exist, even if we might not be talking to them today, I don't think necessarily everyone realizes the extent of his musical influence. We had Chuck D on earlier today talking about, you know, the influence that Michael Jackson had on his work with Public Enemy.
I think, you know, the thing about Michael's music was, as someone we just heard said in Detroit, he was so original. And Michael did things, you know, I think about a tune, She's Out of My Life. And Michael sang this tune, and it was almost like a lament. And he sang, and at the end of the song, he almost sounds as if he's crying. And I think that was revolutionary in pop music. And so with his music, with his originality, I think he really inspired a whole group of musicians to find their own voice and to look for that originality.
Let's listen to some of that.
Damn indecision and cursed pride. I kept my love for her locked deep inside, and it cuts like a knife. She's out of my life.
You said that last night people were also arguing about his skin color and about his nose. Talk about how the fact that that is even part of the conversation. You feel as a journalist that you have to bring it up. Already today, we heard from Chuck D from Public Enemy saying, this is not part of the legacy. We shouldn't be talking about this. Well, how fair is that?
Well, I think it's fair. I think, you know, I think that's fair. But I think in the end, in the final analysis, what people will remember are these tunes. You know, people will be able to separate the man from, or his lifestyle from the music, you know. But there were so many positive things that he did. Think about all the charities that Michael supported. He supported as many charities as he had hits almost. But this thing of skin color came up last night, and I think, you know, that goes back to, you know, how Michael and his brothers came up. They came up in the late 60s when, you know, you saw black power movements and shouts of, you know, black is beautiful. And they had these afros, and they, you know, they could sing and they could dance. And it really seemed like they were dead center in all of what it meant to be black in the late 60s and early 70s. So I think as Michael's skin problem developed, there, particularly in the black community, there was some suspicion about, you know, was he trying to get away from his culture, from his heritage, from who he was as a black man? And so that was what the discussion was about last night in regards to his skin color.
And Amanda, you got some recording last night of fans singing along to Man in the Mirror. So there was extemporaneous singing?
Yeah, it was really, really touching. There was there were a lot of people on the lawn of the Motown Museum, and there were some cars parked along Grand Boulevard, you know, the doors thrown open. And at one point, someone, you know, put Man in the Mirror on their stereo, and everyone just kind of stopped a little bit. And
okay, let's listen. There you go. Fans singing along to Man in the Mirror in front of the Motown Historical Museum. Amanda, I love that. That must have been so much fun to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that song in particular, Terrence, if we were going to pick songs that best summed up both the paradox and the glory of Michael Jackson's career, that would be one of them, wouldn't it?
That would be one. And I think another one, Catherine, might be Off the Wall, because Michael Jackson really lived his life off the wall. And, you know, that really speaks to the original composer, the original entertainer that he was and constantly evolved into.
Hey, Terrence, I want to thank you for joining us today. That's Terrence McKnight, host of WNYC's Evening Music, Amanda LeClaire of WDET Public Radio in Detroit. Thanks for that wonderful tape of people singing. Now we're going to listen to Michael himself, the Man in the Mirror. We want to know, what did the man in the mirror look like to you, Michael Jackson? Lucy writes to us, I am deeply saddened by the death of such a brilliant talent, but not surprised. No one can deny his talent, but many people are to blame for his early death. I loved Michael Jackson, but I worry about how he was allowed to destroy himself. He was a lonely man. We're remembering Michael Jackson. We want your memories. Tell us what you think his legacy should be. 8778 My Take, MyTake at thetakeaway.org. That's why I'm starting with me.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry, who's away. Michael Jackson has died at the age of 50, and we want to know, what's the first one of his songs that you heard?
My first Michael Jackson song would have to be Ben. I can't remember what year it came out,
but that would be my first one. His legacy will be of one of a brilliant performer with a lot of idiosyncrasies that probably drove a lot of people away. He was a talented young man, and sorry to see him gone.
In the two of us need look no more. We both found what we were looking for. With the friend.
Best song about a rat ever. That's the song Ben by the Jackson 5 from 1972. We'd like to know, what did Michael Jackson mean to you? What do you think his legacy is? You can tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Also want to remind you that if you go to thetakeaway.org, you will see wonderful photos from Michael Jackson mourners gathering last night at the Apollo Theater. Terrence McKnight took those photos. You want to see them. Some really nice pics. Going overseas now. In Iran, the day of the election, the internet was shut down completely. In the last 2 weeks, it's been slowed down, hacked, and carefully monitored. Now, if you're wondering how the Iranians were able to set up such a deliberate firewall so quickly, one person who can tell you is Rafael Rosinsky. He's a principal investigator with OpenNet Initiative. It's a university collaboration that aims to analyze internet filtering and surveillance practices. They have a new report out looking at the Iranian firewall. He's also a CEO of Siphon. It's a company that sells products to circumvent firewalls. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Okay, now how were things getting blocked?
Well, one of several ways. First of all, the Iranians for several years now have been running a number of products on their national firewall that essentially blocks access to certain sites. What that means is that if you try to retrieve, for example, the BBC's Persian service, you get a page that says this resource is not available in Iran. More recently, they've also taken to erasing records of websites. So, for example, if you try to retrieve a particular blog or something, the actual address doesn't appear anymore, so you can't get to it.
Okay. Now, what I think it's fair to say, then, that we shouldn't have been necessarily surprised by the so-called Twitter revolution or the fact that people were getting around these blocks because they've been in place for a while, right?
Well, that's true. And also, I think it's worthwhile to note that the Iranian population, both inside Iran and outside, is quite tech-savvy. Prior to the Iranian Revolution in 1979, IBM had a full division in the country, and there was a time in which Iran actually had more mainframes than any other country outside of the U.S. So this population, this Iranian population, has really taken on the challenge thrown down by it by the authorities and tried to get through the firewall as best they can.
Yeah, you mentioned IBM. There's been a lot of chatter lately about who exactly is helping the Iranian government put up firewalls and who exactly is helping them stop the opposition from either getting information or getting information out.
Well, one of the bitter ironies is that although in North America and in the U.S. in particular, we have a Freedom of Internet Support Act, at the same time, it's really U.S. companies that have been in the lead in providing filtering software products to Iran. Now, we can't say whether these products have been sold legally or whether they've been obtained by the Iranians in other ways, but there it is. It's our software that's actually helping block things.
Wow. So what do you do with that? Who do you decide is the actual author of the action of blocking?
Well, I mean, it's clearly the Iranian authorities that make the decision in terms of what content it's blocked. The software simply just makes it easier to happen.
What are the ways that people use to get around internet firewalls?
Well, there are several different ways. One of the most popular is using something called internet proxies. These are like tiny little bypass nodes that effectively allow you to get to content indirectly in ways that is very difficult to block. So, for example, in our case with Siphon, we send a link using Twitter, using email, using other means to Iranian users that says, press this. And if you press this, it'll take you to the Voice of America's Persian service. Now, that link doesn't say Voice of America, but that's where it takes you.
Is that how we come to hear news stories that say that people are playing various online games as a way to get out news of, say, demonstrations?
Correct. It's the attack of the ants. Basically, the more tiny little holes, the more tiny little bypasses you can create in the firewall, the more difficult it is for authorities to centrally block it.
Rather than filtering the internet, if you are a government that wants to make sure certain things don't happen, why don't you just shut it down?
Well, that's a very good point. And last year, we saw exactly that happening in Burma, where the authorities were very concerned about ongoing street demonstrations, so they simply shut down the internet and the cell phone system. With a country like Iran, it's a little bit more difficult. 23 million people online, and certainly a good chunk of the economy depending on instantaneous global communications that the internet represents. So although we saw in the days after the elections a slowdown in the Iranian internet, they certainly have not taken the drastic step of trying to shut it down.
Now, have you taken a look at exactly what they've chosen to block? What surprises are there?
Well, there are not really very many surprises. Mm. They block international mass media, in particular that which comes in the Farsi language. They also block a lot of Persian language blogs. One of the interesting things is after the U.S., one of the first countries to really take blogging on board was Iran, and there are over 60,000 blogs, many of them having political content. So these have also been targeted.
All right. Talk about how technology can both work for free expression and work against it, and what we do with this double-edged sword.
Well, one of the paradoxes, I think, about the internet, which of course has dominated the policy agenda in the States, is just how insecure it is. The internet was built for resilience, not for security, and as a result, spam, viruses, and other things can pervade, and it's very difficult to find perpetrators of that. But at the same time, that very resilience of the internet means that in countries such as Iran, where opposition, freedom of expression advocates, human rights defenders want to use this wonderful technology in order to network, coordinate activities, they can do that. And at the moment, they can still stay one step ahead of the censors.
All right. Rafael, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
That's Rafael Rozinski. He's a principal investigator with the Open Net Initiative, a university collaboration that aims to analyze internet filtering and surveillance practices. He joined us from Ottawa, Canada. We're going to go now to Richard Hake, who joins us from the newsroom.
Catherine, good morning. Today at the White House, President Obama meets with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. They'll talk about Iran and the war in Afghanistan. Then later today at the White House, they'll also announce a new advisor on domestic violence. In Iran, a senior Iranian cleric is asking the government to harshly punish the leaders of post-election protests. The Ayatollah spoke during Muslim Friday prayers at Tehran University. That's after the country's top legislative body says the election was the fairest the country has ever held. In Iraq, more violence with just 4 days before U.S. troops are set to pull out of cities. A booby-trapped motorcycle loaded with nails and ball bearings exploded in a crowded market, killing at least 15 people today. And South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford admits he used state money to visit his mistress in Argentina while on a trip there last year.
All right. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Catherine Lanford, John Hockenberry is away. That, of course, is Michael Jackson. Now, from his obsession with plastic surgery to his legal and financial troubles, Michael Jackson did have his eccentricities. We've been asking people for their memories of Michael Jackson, what legacy they think he's going to leave. Not all of them are positive. Here's one of our listeners.
I just wanted to say that Michael Jackson's legacy is that he's pretty much a weirdo, pedophile, destructive member of society. I don't care what achievements he's made in entertainment.
That's one view, so we'd like to know, what's yours? What will Jackson be remembered for? His large body of work as a musical artist and performer? Or his latter-day eccentricities? You can tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to go now to John Pareles. He's the chief pop critic for the New York Times. He has a piece of analysis already out this morning. John, what is the legacy, hey, that is going to follow Michael Jackson as he eases on down that road?
Well, I think both of the things you mentioned, both the music and the personal freakishness, what I was saying in my story was that I think they were intertwined. I think people always saw that he was strange within his amazing musical skills, that there was always this surface of musical genius, and then within it was this frightened, strange oddball. And I think the combination of them was what made him so universally appealing.
Well, in fact, you talked about the paradox of his stardom. What is appealing about that kind of paradox?
Well, I think we all feel like misfits, speaking purely for myself. I think we all feel like we're alone and vulnerable somewhere. And Michael Jackson was, as a performer, he was superhuman. I saw, you know, his the spectacles he had, and you would see this person singing, dancing, doing all these amazing moves with total perfection, and you think that this person is, either you would think he was a robot or you would think he was an athlete. But he's always singing about fear. He's singing about fear in Thriller. He's singing about fear in Beat It. He's singing about how terrified and lonely he feels often. And that combination, if he was purely a robot, if he was purely perfect, he wouldn't be as interesting. I think the imperfection draws people to him. Mm-hmm. And he kept telling people how weird he was. I mean, his first solo album was called Off the Wall. It's not like he was hiding this particularly, but he was balancing it for the best albums of his career.
You mentioned the album Thriller. Talk about that as the before and after moment of his life.
Well, I mean, he was already a star. Off the Wall was a success in standard pop terms. Millions of copies, hit singles. But Thriller was a new quantum level. Thriller was a new order of magnitude. Thriller had seven hit singles. It's the best-selling album of all time. It also reached everybody. It was very strategic in that he had a rock guitar on Beat It. He had Paul McCartney for old Beatles fans. He had Wanna Be Starting Something for people who wanted dance music. He really went out of his way to make it something for every format. He looked at the situation of radio and of other ways to promote music in the 80s, and he saw that everything was divided into formats. He gave something for every slot. And, he drew together the pop audience for what was really its last hurrah before it fragmented again.
Hmm. And it became as much of a burden as it was a triumph for him.
Well, definitely. I think that, people think that music careers are supposed to be like companies, that you're supposed to make more profits than you did the last year. And Jackson, after Thriller came out, when he made Bad, I read articles where he had posted on the wall of his studio the words 100 million. In other words, that was going to be his goal, that he had to outdo Thriller. And that, of course, can make you crazy because you start thinking about what can I do to get a bigger audience, not where is my music, not what's coming out of me, but what can I do for someone else. And I think that's really tough for an artist.
You said that made him crazy. There are, I think, people out there who would take that literally. And talk about the strains of his life that emerged later that for some will always color his legacy.
Well, horrible stuff. I mean, the accusations of pedophilia, the financial disaster, the plastic surgery that turned a really handsome guy into someone who looked stranger than anything. Obviously, this was not a, you know, happy-go-lucky personality. I never met him. I never interviewed him. So I couldn't tell you, you know, anything from personal experience. But just the public performance, it gave the public something to look at. And I think that's something that's part of a pop star's job is to be a public figure. The public figure he cut was not one that showed any kind of happiness or stability. But then you put him on a stage with his white socks and his white glove, and you get one of those tracks going, and he was amazing.
Talk about the place of anger in his work.
I think, that's interesting. I mean, anger came out later. Anger came out on Dangerous and History, the two albums where he really... You had the feeling he was almost cornered, snarling in his cave. History especially. He started History as one of those greatest hits albums that was going to have two extra new songs or a couple of extra new songs, standard, you know, make some money gambit. And apparently he went into the studio and just kept recording and recording until he had a whole album. But on that album are three songs, Tabloid Junkie, They Don't Care About Us, and DS, which seems to be about the prosecuting attorney in California, though it's changed for libel reasons. And it's just about how completely persecuted and angry he feels. And he's really lashing out. There was also a remix of some of the songs of History where he's just about screaming. I mean, finally, he cracks in that. And it's scary and kind of fascinating and almost more human than his more polished stuff. But it's also, it's really angry. And what he's angry at is the media who he's courted all his life. So it's a real paradox. The media helped make him, and he teased and played with and supplied the media with everything from music videos to, you know, pictures of him sleeping in his hyperbaric chamber. But then as they became more voracious and he became more reclusive, he turned on them and they turned on him.
All right, John Perales, I'm afraid that we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
John Perales, the chief pop critic for our partners, the New York Times.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, and for John Hockenberry. Michael Jackson's death is, of course, causing shockwaves around the world among fans. But now we're going to go to the United Kingdom, where Michael Jackson's fan base is so strong he chose London as the venue for his comeback concerts. Those concerts were going to start in just 2 weeks and would have been the first time in over a decade that Michael Jackson had appeared on stage. Chris Hawkins is a presenter on the BBC's Digital Music Channel 6. He is joining us now. Chris, why was Michael Jackson going to open his comeback concert in the UK? What was the draw of the UK for him?
It seems, Catherine, like it was safe territory for him. His fan base here is enormous, as big, I would say, as it is in the States. 750,000 people bought tickets for the shows, which, as you've said, were due to start in 2 weeks' time. And it really is, the atmosphere here in the UK is really quite subdued. Everyone is talking about the fact that Michael Jackson is dead.
So if we use the phrase shockwaves, that's not an overstatement from what you can see.
I was first made aware of this news last night. I was leaving a pub, and it's something that will stick with me forever. I was leaving a pub, and a car just pulled up in the street, wound down the window, and just shouted to the group of us that were leaving, Michael Jackson's dead. And that will always stick in my mind. It's such a big deal. It was such big news that the driver of that car felt the need to share that news with other people.
Now, we know that Paul McCartney has released a statement within the last hour on his website. Tell us what he said, and also describe a little bit the twists and turns of that relationship.
Yes, of course. They duetted together, and Michael Jackson, of course, famously bought the Beatles' back catalogue, and we'll never know the real details about the relationship between the two of them, but Paul McCartney has said that it's so sad and shocking. I feel privileged to have hung out and worked with Michael. He's a massively talented boy man with a gentle soul. His music will be remembered forever, and my memories of our times together will be happy ones. And Paul McCartney, just one of the hundreds of musicians in the UK paying tribute to Michael Jackson.
To get to a more temporal moment, and that would be, what about the people who bought tickets to the concerts? Do they get their money back? What happens?
Yes, It's going to be a complicated process, of course. 750,000 refunds will need to be issued, but the arena where Michael Jackson was due to play, the O2 Arena, have said now that everyone will get full refunds. But you know what? I don't think any of those fans would want the refunds. I think everyone wanted to see their hero, that everyone was excited. There was a real buzz building. There was a sense of nervousness that Michael Jackson wasn't prepared yet for these concerts. And the latest rumours were that he was only actually going to perform for about 8 minutes of the whole show. He would actually only be on the stage for about 8 minutes himself. Despite that, everyone was geared up and getting excited about the prospect of seeing him play live. Perhaps, and it probably would have been, for the last time in the UK.
All right. Chris Hawkins, thanks for that picture.
Thanks, Catherine.
Chris Hawkins, he's a presenter on the BBC program BBC 6 Music.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry is away. Michael Jackson has died at the age of 50, and we want to know, what did he mean to you?
Hi, this is Brian Wilkie calling from Brooklyn, New York. Michael Jackson created the soundtrack to my life, and no one can take that away from him, or me, for that matter. We all make mistakes. Michael made lots, but we are what we create, not what people perceive us to be.
All right, what Michael Jackson song is in your life soundtrack? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And I've been dying to ask this question all morning. Richard Hake, you're here from the newsroom. But tell me, what is your favorite song?
It has to be Thriller. Because, you know, you can dance to this song. It was like one of the best music videos that they ever made.
Can you do headlines to this song?
You could probably moonwalk to this song.
Uh-oh.
I'm not going to try.
Please.
I love that part. And Jonathan Pryce is in this. Vincent Price.
I was going to say, Vincent, I think you mean Vincent Price. Jonathan Pryce was in a musical.
Of course, coming up.
You got it all mixed up.
I know. That's a great song. But so an autopsy that was for Michael Jackson is planned for later today. Final results aren't likely until tests are completed by next week. Motown Records head Berry Gordy.
Michael Jackson doesn't just come along once in a century or a lifetime. He only comes along once.
As the news spread, fans around the world are holding vigils. Here's reaction from India.
In Bollywood movies, you know, see lots of people who copying and who try to act, you know, the way he acts. So people are like crazy about him.
Within hours of his death, Michael Jackson albums took up 3/4 of the best-selling list on the web retailer Amazon.com. Other stories we're following for you on Capitol Hill. House Democrats are trying to win over a handful of undecided lawmakers for a vote today on a climate change bill. Opponents from both parties say the bill will raise taxes. It's emerged that South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford used state money to visit his mistress in Argentina last year. He says he'll pay the money back. Critics are calling for his resignation. And at the White House, the president will meet with the German chancellor today. Iran and Afghanistan will top their agenda. And then later today at the White House, they'll announce a new advisor on domestic violence. Those are some of the stories we're following for you.
Okay. Thanks so much, Richard.
You're welcome.
What is happening with the GOP? Both John Ensign and Mark Sanford are the latest casualties of controversy in the Republican Party, both admitting to extramarital affairs. It seems as fast as they get named as 2012 presidential hopefuls, the faster these candidates come tumbling down. Joining us now are two prominent advisors and strategists in the Republican Party. Grover Norquist is the president of Americans for Tax Reform. He's also the author of Leave Us Alone, getting the government's hands off our money, our guns, our lives. Ron Kaufman is a former White House political director under George H.W. Bush, and he's also an advisor to Mitt Romney. Grover, we're going to start with you, and we're going to start with the governor of South Carolina. What effect does this particular scandal have on the bloc of fiscally conservative voters such as yourself?
Well, obviously, Sanford was a tremendous leader on the call for spending less money, and he governed well as a governor. He's one of about five or six governors who've done as he has in terms of keeping spending down and governing as a Ronald Reagan Republican. It's a disappointment that he would not be in the mix, but that leaves the governor of Minnesota, Mr. Pawlenty, the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, the governor of Alaska, Palin, a number of solid Republican governors who could run for president in 4 years.
I'm going to turn over to you, Ron. And just to get your quick take on how these two particular controversies are going to hurt.
Well, they hurt the Republican brand, I think, a little bit, because we're the party who family values and claim that we want to bring stability to the American people. But as Grover said, we're really the party that governs well and governs wisely and taxes less and spends less. And I think that doesn't affect that brand at all. And I think as we go through the next couple of years and as the deficit gets bigger and bigger and bigger and people focus more and more what this means to our kids and our grandkids, I think our brand gets better and better, and these problems won't really affect how people are going to vote in 2010 or 2012.
Well, in fact, is Sanford really such a loss to you folks anyway? I mean, he might have been great as a label for the party, but in – like Time Magazine, I think, rated him as one of the least effective governors. He really, when you look at how the schools were doing, when you look at how industry was doing there, how much of a leader was he really?
Well, certainly Sanford was strong in trying to stop the government, the state legislature, from spending too much. He had a legislature that's filled with a lot of Democrats who flipped to become Republicans to keep their seats, but they're still spendaholics. And so there was an awful lot of beating his head against a wall with that legislature. I think it might have been difficult for him to run for president because of that, because his hometown guys would have said, well, he wasn't very effective. Well, he's fairly effective at stopping bad stuff from happening, which is step one for a governor or a president when it comes to overspending. And these elections, 2010, 2012, will be about who can stop the runaway spending that you saw at the end of the Bush administration, but then went into hyperspeed with Reid and Pelosi and Obama?
Well, let's talk about what contenders you do have. Ron, I'm going to go back to you for a moment.
Well, of course, my guy is Mitt Romney, and if he decides to run again, I think he'd be a strong candidate. But as Grover said, there are a ton of very good, solid, conservative governors across the country who I think will be really good candidates potentially in 2012. But listen, we're a long time away. If this was 2005, and we had this conversation, none of us on this phone would mention some junior senator from Illinois as a potential candidate for president in 2008. So we're a long way away. I think that the party's actually in better shape than people realize, and I think that we will have a really good year in 10. I think actually we elect two Republican governors in 2009, which will lead to 2010.
Now, Grover, let me ask you this, though. Is this possibly maybe the final scandal like this we're going to have in which we all agree on whatever side of the aisle you're on? Enough already with people's private lives. We don't care if you're a president with an intern, if you are a governor with a woman in Argentina, if you're a senator with a staffer, only until it affects your private life are we going to care? Because at this point, there has been political bloodshed on for both parties.
Well, if the head of the Republican Party and the head of the Democratic Party could get in a room and cut a deal like that, it might work. But this is really up to the American people and voters to decide how they view it. And some of these scandals are more permanently damaging to the individuals themselves than others. But I think because of the nature of the threat to the economy, that people will be focused more on who can stop the runaway spending. And since Obama started his massive spending spree, unemployment's gotten worse, not better. So it's had the opposite effect of what the Democrats said was going to happen.
All right. Let's talk about what your advice would be then to Republican candidates who are looking at 2012. Because you're right, it is a long way away. I mean, why do we even play this game anyway?
Because it shows talk airtime on radio and TV. People care. I mean, the next president will matter. What's happening now really matters. And I think my advice to anyone running is to go back to conservative basic roots, and not ideological roots, but conservative roots. Ronald Reagan always said that ideology, rigid ideology, was evil, and I think he was right. We go back to what William Buckley said and Burke and the rest, that this is really about basic conservative values, and if a Republican candidate gets out there and goes back to those roots, I think we'll have a really, really good year in 2012.
All right. I'd like to thank you both for joining us. Grover Norquist, President of Americans for Tax Reform. Ron Kaufman, former White House political director and a friend and advisor to former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Meanwhile, we've also been talking this morning about how Michael Jackson has died at the age of 50, and we want to know, what will you remember about him?
I was already a teenager when Michael Jackson hit the scene, and I was big into Motown, but I had a neighbor next door who was a bit younger than me, and I think at her 12th birthday, she had a birthday party on a Saturday afternoon, and I could hear the music, and it seemed like all they were playing all day long was
ABC.
And that was the first time I heard it, and it was really great.
Baby, you and me, girl.
Tell us what you think Michael Jackson's legacy will be at H778MyTake or at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Meanwhile, we're going to go out on some fans singing along last night to the song Man in the Mirror, gathered outside the Motown Museum in Detroit. This is our tribute. I'm Catherine Lanfer, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Who's that?
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.